05AP121, Lina M. Mueller v. McMillian Warner Insurance Company. Paul David will have 25 minutes, and he is representing Merlin A. Switlick and Stephanie Switlick. Counsel?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, and guests. My name is Paul David, and I represent Stephanie Switlick and Merlin Switlick in this action. We are here today to discuss the interpretation and application of Section 895.48 Parens 1 WSSTATS, commonly referred to as the Good Samaritan Immunity Statute. Briefs have been filed, and I don't want to restate or rediscuss everything, but there certainly seems to be certain issues that have become primarily important. And these are the style or method of interpretation of the statute. Secondly, the statutory requirements of scene of any emergency or accident, the statutory requirement of emergency care, the statutory requirement of good faith, which we in our briefs have indicated touches upon the concept of a standard of care in this case, which is an issue that the court wanted specifically addressed when it accepted this matter. And finally, the appropriateness of granting summary judgment. With regard to the interpretation of the statute, I think it has been briefed and established this is an immunity statute. And as such, a narrow interpretation is going to be appropriate. However, I think there's a couple of points that are important to make on that issue. Even though we conclude that there is a narrow interpretation in this case, you still need to look at the language of the statute. And I think you need to ask, is this a statute that utilizes language that evinces a broad intent, an intent of broad application, or an intent of narrow application? And when we look at the language, I think there's a couple of key phrases that you need to look at. Initially, it says any person. Broad language, broad application. Scene of any emergency or accident. And when that language is considered in light of the legislative history, in which there used to be a definition for that provision, at least for scene of emergency, it was a definition that was drafted extremely broadly. As a result, that indicates an intent to have broad application of this statute. Finally, the statute's express application to both acts and omissions indicates a broad application, and as we all know, the application to omissions is particularly important given the allegations that have been made by the plaintiff in this case. So simply because we conclude that there's a narrow interpretation according to the rules of interpretation, it doesn't mean that you don't end up with a statute of broad application. The broad language ultimately needs to be considered in the final interpretation of the statute. The second point with regard to interpretation is there's been a lot of discussion in the briefs about this statute being a statute that is in derogation of the common law. And the concept there is that if we apply this law, the person that is injured is left without some kind of a remedy or an ability to seek compensation for the injuries. However, this immunity statute applies to an interaction between individuals in certain circumstances. And that interaction occurs only after the person, or one of the persons in that interaction, has already been injured. Assuming that the party was initially injured as a result of negligent conduct or the tortfeasor's conduct, there is a remedy that is going to exist despite the application of the Good Samaritan statute. That is exactly what is happening in this case. If the court concludes that the Good Samaritan immunity applies in this case, the injured party still has remedy against a tortfeasor. Now, that
Who's
doesn't mean
this... Who's the tortfeasor here?
Apollo Switlick.
Pardon me?
Apollo Switlick. And there is also another claim that
Could
has
Apollo
been...
Apollo be liable for, if there was negligence here on the by his parents, would he be liable for that as an ordinary course of the tort, his tort?
Apollo will be liable for the claim that has been brought against him for negligent operation of the ATV. There is another claim and for the damages. There is another claim that has been brought against Merlin and Stephanie Switlick, which is not the subject of this appeal. It is based upon the provision of alcohol. And that is not subject here, and it is a cause of action that will stand regardless of whether or not there is application of the Good Samaritan immunity. This defense was raised in response to particular allegations that were made by the plaintiff in the amended complaint, where it was alleged that a cause of action should lie because they negligently failed to provide certain things that they say they should have provided.
Now, counsel, one of the arguments between the two of you is over emergency, and the facts show, and without going, that there was the emergency lasted 6 to 7 hours from the time they returned. Is that when it started, when they returned to the shack, the building?
Certainly, that's
okay. And then it lasted until they called 911.
The application of the immunity applies during that time period. That's correct.
And the argument that opposing counsel makes is, well, look, that is a emergency calls for, the emergency is a much shorter period of time. And here it was more like a, they say, babysit, or is it just a care, whatever, waking the person up, but it didn't fall into the category of emergency. And the issue is, of course, when should they have called 911?
That's correct, and the allegation is that they didn't call 911 and they should have. But the reason that you have to apply the immunity statute to all of those events is because of really what gives rise to that omission. That omission occurs because initially, when I think we can all agree that there was the scene of an emergency, the first thing that the Switlicks had to do and the first thing that any layperson Samaritan has to do is have to do some type of an assessment, a determination for themselves as to what they are going to do or how they are going to respond on behalf of this injured person.
Well, I want to back up a little bit. You said we can all agree that there's a scene of an emergency. And as I read the statute reads scene of an emergency or accident. Now, I think it's fairly clear that there was an accident here. But can you have a scene of an emergency if an emergency is not recognized?
Yes, and I think what you're touching upon is an argument that's been raised about whether or not you evaluate scene of emergency based upon an objective standard, or if you define it based upon the subjective standard. That
but being, you're after the fact. My question goes to, is there an emergency if nobody sees it as an emergency? If the person who's involved in the accident doesn't see it as an emergency, if the person who's viewing the person that's involved in the accident doesn't see it as an emergency, at what point does it become an emergency? At the time of the accident?
At the time that the injury is incurred. At the time that an injury is incurred, at in which we would determine on an objective basis that an intervention by another person would be of benefit to that injured person.
Well, that's very different than saying that the emergency starts early. Here's the problem that I have. As a parent, anyone who's had children knows that oftentimes children will get scruffed up, they'll get injured, they may be bleeding, and you sit there and you look at it, and some situations are clearly emergencies, and you rush them out and you take them to the emergency room. There are other times when they're not emergencies. You know, you fell off, you skinned your knee, put a Band-Aid on it, get out of here. And so my question really goes to the definition of emergency. It's one thing to say scene of accident, but is an emergency before anybody recognizes it to be an emergency?
I would say yes, because the condition of the injured child is what it is. The injury is, be it a severed leg or a cut or whatever it may be, the perception of the caregiver does not define whether or not that emergency exists. That emergency is there. Now, the caregiver might not do such a good job of determining whether or not it is an emergency, but the injury is what it is. And that's why we are advancing that you need to use an objective standard in order to try to determine the scene of an emergency. And in this case, I think there's something in addition that you need to add to that scenario. They are alleging that Lena Mueller presented to the Switlicks with symptoms of severe injuries. Now, they never used the word scene of an emergency in there, but I think we can, that is what was being done. They are alleging that there was a scene of an emergency, and they should have responded to it as a scene of an emergency, but they failed to because they failed to, in the first instance, assess the severity of the situation.
Could I ask, the plaintiff here arrived at this party independently, did she not?
I believe that the facts would support that, yes.
After the accident, could the Switlicks have simply said, well, she's got her own way home, let's go home, let's leave her here?
There has been some discussion in this case about restatement second of torts and whether or not any of those could apply to create a duty. Some of those arguments have not been consistent with what the rule of law is in the state of Wisconsin regarding duty. The law with regard to duty is that everyone has a duty to act with reasonable care. Now, that means that essentially there may or may not have been a duty that arose in the Switlicks when Lena Mueller presented back to the scene. Now, whether or not they could have not responded in any way and backed off and satisfied that duty, I guess that's a different question or somewhat of a different analysis. But if what you're getting at is, did they have a duty to intervene? Well, we all have a duty at all times. That's the law in the state of Wisconsin. Now, whether they
It seems to me I might not be a good person, but if I see an accident at the side of the road and I just keep on going, I'm not sure I can be held liable in tort for that. I mean, doesn't the law say, gee, we'd really like you to stop and try to help, and if you do, we're going to give you an immunity?
Whether or not you can avoid liability by simply diverting your eyes and proceeding on, I don't think the answer to that is clearly that you can avoid immunity by doing that. I just quote to the case of Dixon versus Wisconsin Health Organization Insurance Corporation, 2000 Wis 95, quote, in Wisconsin, failure to take an affirmative action may constitute negligence when that failure is inconsistent with the duty to exercise ordinary care. In McNeese versus Peer, 174 Wis 2D, it says, now generally, a person does not breach her duty of exercising reasonable care simply by being present at the scene of an accident. But whether or not reasonable care means engaging or acting or trying to provide some aid or assistance, I don't think it's a clear-cut rule that you can just step back and say, I'm not going to get involved because I don't want to get I don't know that that's clearly the law.
Well, do we need to decide that here? Because they did act here, or didn't? Maybe that's what you're trying to say, that they didn't act at all?
No.
Is that what you're trying to say?
No. Our position would be that they did act.
They did act. So now we're off whether they had a duty, because they have moved in.
Yes.
And done something. And then the issue is, once they've moved in and done something, whether they're going to fall into the Good Samaritan law that protects somebody who renders emergency care at the scene of any emergency or accident. You're not saying this is at the scene of an accident.
No, this would be the scene of emergency.
Any person who renders emergency care at the scene of any emergency in good faith. Emergency care, scene of any emergency, in good faith, shall be immune. So you're really looking for immunity. Because if you don't get immunity, then they're going to fall into the general negligence. It may be that they were not negligent, right? We're not deciding that here.
That's correct.
But you want to get them out of liability before we look at negligence, before another court looks at negligence.
Absolutely.
You want an absolute bar to that. Is that a third cause of action for them again on negligence? Is that it?
I'm sorry.
There's a cause of action against the Switlicks personally for negligence? And that's
yes.
How the defense arose. Is that,
that
it?
That is correct.
Okay.
Well, your argument is that emergency and whatever they did, it was in good faith. They weren't, these were lay people. They weren't experts or had any medical training that I saw in the brief. So basically, they did what they thought was best under the conditions presented, right?
That is correct.
It's a good faith. So you have to have good faith because, as I posed my first question, you know, I have, if they fall under emergency, and that was the issue, how long, it seems like it's a temporal thing. I mean, that's argued by opposing counsel, but these people presented themselves. They were in a little different capacity, and I don't want to get into this, but they were there because they were expected to be at that house. One was a son, the other was a girlfriend of the son. So it's just what they did after they came back. So even though you said the emergency happened at the accident, the emergency really is when they presented themselves at the home.
That's correct.
And yes. And they both were bleeding. And the good faith argument comes in, even though it's a long time, whatever they did, it was in good faith and fall under the statute.
And in particular, the reason that we have sort of a longer time frame in conjunction with these facts and scenarios is because of one of the initial caregiving acts that was given in good faith, and that was the assessment of the situation. Unfortunately, as a result of that assessment, the severity of the injuries were not determined, but that assessment was done in good faith. And as a result, what they did was they provided the care that they felt that that initial assessment indicated that they should provide. Now, that drew the time frame out. But what's interesting in this case is that the allegations are not that what they did then over that time period was negligent. It wasn't that the cold rag was applied to the head negligently or that she was placed into the bed negligently. The continuing theory of negligence during that time period is that they failed to call 911.
You keep indicating they. It's my understanding that the husband and wife are in a very different situation here, that the wife was basically the person who was giving the care, who was checking on the plaintiff and was making these determinations. Isn't that correct?
That is factually correct.
Are they in the same position?
I don't believe that they are in the same position, and the use of the word they probably was inappropriate. I think what the facts are supported by the record here are is that Merlin Switlick did initially assist or engage in part of that evaluation process, but then because of what that evaluation or assessment resulted, Stephanie Switlick then assumed the primary responsibility for Lena Mueller.
Counselor, a lot of the terms that you ask us to define, scene of the emergency, emergency care, have the facts established, and from what the facts are, we can interpret the statute. But from my reading of the brief, it appears as though good faith remains a question of fact. And what I draw your attention to is the inferences that are given that the reason the initial care was to keep Lina at the Switlick's cottage was because she was underage and drinking, and Apollo was underage and drinking. And whether or not that was a motivation for the result of the initial assessment, isn't that a question of fact that we really can't determine here?
Ultimately, I think good faith will often turn on the facts of the case. However, I think summary judgment is appropriate in this case when and due to the fact that if we look at summary judgment methodology per 80202 WIS stats, we find that what the defendants did in this case was essentially establish a basis for the immunity to apply. We believe that we established via affidavits, primarily the affidavit of John Kramer that included all of the affidavit the testimony of the witnesses and the participants in this matter, that there was the scene of an emergency and that there was either emergency care that was provided or omitted. These allegations that there is a separate motivation or that there is bad faith involved was raised, I would argue, primarily, at least in their current form, they were raised primarily for the first time in the reply to the petition for review to the Supreme Court.
So you say they're not anywhere else in any affidavit or any other exhibit that's been submitted that the trial court considered on summary judgment?
Not in their current form.
Well, what do you mean by that? That's kind of a hedge.
There is allegations at this point in time that Merlin and Stephanie Switlick did what they did because they were afraid of criminal prosecution. That was not presented until the petition for review, or the reply to the petition for review to the Supreme Court. There was a discussion about good faith in the Court of Appeals brief, but those allegations that I just talked about were not raised until actually we've gotten to the Supreme Court level. And the other thing that I want to say is that it's one thing to just say that, that anybody could find these things from the evidence. It's another thing to present those properly in summary judgment procedure and format so that they can, in fact, say a reasonable inference has arisen that allows you to say that is a fact issue that prevents this from resulting in summary judgment.
In order to win, you have to prevail on all three. A scene of the emergency, emergency care, and good faith. If you lose on any one of those, you don't have your client doesn't have immunity. Is that right?
I see those all as fundamental elements of the immunity, and that if any one of them does not apply, the immunity would fail.
And it would seem to me that what is meant by scene of emergency, emergency care, and good faith are legal issues, and whether what the facts are, that what happened here would be factual issues, and ultimately whether the facts as found fit these legal standards is usually a question of law, although if there's a jury trial, it might amount to that the jury makes that determination. Is that how you see it?
The facts are clearly important to the application of this case, but I think the facts are fairly straightforward, and the relevant facts that will bear on whether or not this immunity applies are really for the most part undisputed, and that's an assertion that was even made by the plaintiffs in this case. I think it's important to always remember what the allegation of negligent omission is in this case, because that's part of it. It's not just the facts of the case, it's what is it that they're alleging that we omitted. And what they're alleging we omitted is calling 911, delivering the person to the hospital. Under even the plaintiff's argument about what constitutes emergency care, those are acts of emergency care. So the claim to which we're trying to address this summary judgment motion is a claim that alleges the omission of emergency care at the scene of an emergency. So not just the facts of the case, but also what the allegations of omissions are important.
Counsel, I want to touch on emergency care and just push that definition a little beyond the facts of this case. The facts of this case, as I understand it, is that the victim was 6 or 7 hours in the cottage before being transported medical care. What if the victim, the plaintiff here, were there for 24 hours being observed? Would the 23rd and 22nd hour of that time period still fall within your definition of emergency care?
I think the time frame is not something that should ultimately determine the application of the immunity. I think what would need to be looked at in that case is good faith.
Well, that's a separate thing, though.
But if those 24 hours can be looked at, and it can be said the reason that that arose mm-hmm. is because their good faith efforts in intervening on behalf of this person led to this series of events, then I think that the immunity has to apply.
I think you're answering that emergency, then getting back to something that Justice Butler brought up, I think the subjective or objective, because you're saying if they had good faith, and even if it wasn't still emergency care, if they had good faith in believing that it was still emergency care, that it is emergency care subjectively, that's what's required under the statute. Hmm? No?
Whether or not there is, in fact, an emergency that exists, the condition of the person is, I think, which defines whether or not there is
emergency
the scene of an emergency.
scene of emergency. I'm talking about emergency care, and I'm trying to explore the temporal nature, if any, of providing emergency care. I mean, for instance, if this young girl were staying at the cottage for a week, and her parents expected her to be there a week, and for a week she was vomiting, and would the fifth day still be providing emergency care?
If ultimately it proved that her condition was such that emergency care should have been provided, then the emergency continues to exist throughout that time period. Now,
let me articulate my question better, because I think I'm not doing such a good job. What's the difference between emergency care and care?
That's been discussed in the briefs quite a bit, and a lot of terms have been thrown around. One thing that hasn't been addressed with any of those things is a recognized delineation between those words, be it a medical-based delineation, a legal-based delineation. It is an argument in many situations that I think is more semantics than it is substance.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel representing Ms. Mueller, Russell T. Gola.
Thank you, counsel. Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, all the guests. In analyzing this case, I think we're all in agreement that this is an immunity statute. It's a statute in derogation of common law. It should be strictly and narrowly construed according to its terms. This court established the statutory, in developing statutory construction, we're looking at plain meaning rather than intended meaning. We want to determine what the people who read this statute, the citizens of the state of Wisconsin, would gather from the words used rather than what the people who wrote the statute intended without expressing. So we look, and we have to look at the statute, and I think the statute is fairly simple in phrasing, but as this case shows, it could be, I don't think in this fact situation, but in other fact situations, a little more difficult to apply. We have to have emergency care. We have to have somebody who renders emergency care, that's the statutory language, renders emergency care at the scene of an emergency or accident in good faith. You have to have all that.
Counselor, can you tell me in response to the response I got from opposing counsel what specifically you submitted to the trial court in opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment that could infer there was a motivation other than the physical condition of Ms. Miller that caused the delay in calling an ambulance?
I cannot cite the page of the argument.
Just tell me what you submitted. It either has to be an affidavit, it has to be some evidence that would support an argument. So I'm asking you for the evidence,
The evidence is very simple. Okay. The evidence are the undisputed facts of this case. That evidence is in the record without dispute. Mr. Apollo Switlick arrived at 2 o'clock that day. His mother and father knew he would be drinking alcohol.
What I want to focus on, they're not calling the ambulance after Ms. Miller was injured. And I want to know if anybody testified in a deposition, if there was anything heard from anybody, said by anybody, any way that there was any kind of evidence that her medical condition and a poor assessment of the seriousness of that was not the sole cause in the delay in calling the ambulance.
Not the sole cause?
Okay. I want to know, can you show me anything in evidence that shows that the Switlicks didn't call the ambulance because the kids were drinking and they were underage?
I think that's a clear inference that could be drawn from the evidence. The clear inference is this. They know Apollo Switlick is there in the afternoon at 2 o'clock and he's drinking from 2 o'clock until 10. The evidence shows he's had a minimum of 7 beers during that period of time. They know that he's been drinking. They know he goes out on the ATV. They know there's an accident. They know the people who come back, Apollo and his girlfriend, had been drinking, and there had been an accident, and their son was driving the ATV.
I think Justice Rogensack's question really is what is the source of that evidence? You say the evidence shows. The testimony, what's the source?
That's the testimony of all the parties. It's in the, we've cited it. It's clearly cited in our brief, in our statement of facts. I think Mr. David agrees completely with that. That's the facts. So we take the facts.
Weren't denied in the answer.
Pardon?
These facts were not denied in the answer.
I don't have the recall of whether they denied those facts in the answer. They've recited these as the facts in their brief as well as
us. Are there affidavits showing those facts?
Yes, there are. Okay. It's incorporating all the testimony that we've referred to.
Right.
So that's the inference of this. And just to complete that, if you will recall, the evidence here shows that Ms. Stephanie Sweetlick, when her son and Lena presented themselves to their house, Lena's sweatshirt is full of blood. She's still bleeding from the nose. She's complaining of headaches. She goes to the bathroom, throws up, and Stephanie says, okay, well, let's lay you down. At that point in time, she said, we considered taking, but chose not to. Now, under these facts, there is a very clear inference that the decision not to take was done at least in part, a cause, not the sole cause, at least in part, by ulterior motivation. That's an issue of fact for the jury to decide, but we don't have to get there at this point.
Mr. Gola, but is that a question of ulterior motivation, or is that a question of factually what they're looking at? If you're sitting there, you're a parent, and you have two underage individuals who have admittedly been drinking and who are showing signs that are related to alcohol consumption, throwing up, the things that were taking place here. As a parent, it seems to me you could sit there, look at that situation, and not see it as an emergency, but see it as, okay, I got two drunken kids here, go sleep it off, and let's just make sure they're all right. Which goes back to the question that I asked before about what constitutes an emergency, when does an emergency arise?
Okay, let me answer both questions. First, you left out one crucial fact in your hypothetical. If that's all they were doing was throwing up and they knew that they were drinking alcohol, it's an alcohol-related thing. But these people presented with Lena with blood all over her sweatshirt with a statement that they had been involved in an accident. Lena is complaining of headaches, okay, and that continues. And they continue to throw up 4 to 5 times, both of them throughout the course of the night. In fact, when the EMTs find them in the morning, they're in bed, and there's throw up on the bed. So,
yet there's no suggestion that, with respect to their son, there was an emergency. So they're both throwing up, they both got headaches, they both were involved in the accident, but there's only the inference that one of them is involved. That's where I'm having trouble parsing what's going on.
The blood is not only on Lena. The blood is all over her sweatshirt. The blood's coming from her nose. He's bleeding from the mouth. He has blood in the back of his head. That was they appreciated that. Those are the facts in the record.
So was there an emergency as to Apollo as well?
The question that I have, and I'm going to get to your question, is when is there an emergency for this case? And the only way that I can think of expressing this very clearly is this. Let's call we have this House of the Good Samaritan, which gives immunity if you get in. The door to get in requires that you render emergency care at the scene of an emergency in good faith. You asked Mr. David if you could have, if the person, now this is the defendant invoking the emergency, can you have an emergency and can you render emergency care if the person invoking the emergency statute and asking for immunity doesn't subjectively perceive the existence of an emergency and objectively take action consistent with that subjective perception? We propose that two-pronged test in our brief. We say very clearly, in order to qualify for this, the person seeking to invoke it must subjectively perceive that they are confronted with an emergency. They must do so in good faith. So if these people, and I ask you, review their depositions, or full depositions are in there, not a word by either one of them that they expected. This is an after-the-fact defense that was thrown in. These people gave testimony. Neither Stephanie nor Merlin said one word about their perception that they were confronted with an emergency. And I think that's the way it has to be, because we have laypersons. We have laypersons that are dealing with this. These are not medical professionals, and that's important, because in dealing with this Good Samaritan statute and dealing with the law that says you cannot practice medicine without a license, you have to balance these two. Where do you switch from one to the other? I think all, as we said, the touchstone of an emergency and the perception of an emergency is, God, I'm dealing with a life-threatening situation for somebody there. I got to take immediate action. I got to do something. And then what do? Everybody. And these days, ever since we started touting 911, knows what you do if you think you're dealing with an emergency. You assess the Red Cross, which we've asked the court to take judicial notice of. You check for victims. You call 911 if you have that capability. And then you care while the competent medical professionals are coming to the scene to take over the care. You cannot play doctor and say, I'm going to assess, if you're claiming there's an emergency, you can't play doctor and say, I'm going to take the role of a neurosurgeon or a neurologist and assume to myself that I know what's happening with this person who's bleeding from the nose, complaining of headaches, and throwing up.
Counselor, but this kind of goes back to Justice Butler's question early on, is you're saying if they don't perceive it as an emergency, then they can't come within the statute. But it seems part of what we're dealing with here is two people who looked at Apollo and Lena and didn't perceive an emergency for either one of them. Now, because they perceived wrong and took care of them as a parent sometimes takes care of a child, you're saying they don't come within the statute. That's kind of tough, isn't it?
That's because what the statute says.
Well,
yeah. You can't have a statute that requires the rendering of emergency care at the scene of an emergency without the person who's doing this actually saying, this is an emergency, I got to give care.
Well, Mr. Gola, let's
can't
see.
Be.
Let's say
not unless you write those words out of the statute. I'm sorry.
Let's say we apply your two-prong test. And in applying that two-prong test, that the person has to subjectively perceive an emergency. My question becomes that on the basis of this record, at least what the Switlicks are arguing, that point took place when the girl says, Mama, in response to a question about, do you know who I am?
Yes.
That was the point at which the perception took place. Now, assuming that the court wants to apply a temporal portion in the application here, doesn't that temporal portion start when the perception starts? And if they call 911 right after that, haven't they then satisfied the statute and gotten in the door?
For what occurs after that perception only, not for the harm that's caused before that.
So you're saying the first 6 or 7 hours, whatever it is, they should be liable for, and they're immune when they call 911. So whatever 911 does or doesn't do, that's not their
And whatever
problem.
Care they administered from the time they called to the time those people showed up, they're immune from that. And I think that's a good common sense approach to this that's drafted for the layperson.
Counselor, what about if I come across an accident when I'm driving home, God forbid, tonight, and I stop at the accident, and it looks to me like the car engine is on fire, and though the engine isn't running anymore, I'm concerned, and there's somebody in the car who's unconscious. So what if I move them out of the car, not realizing that they've got a spinal cord injury? So I didn't realize that. Am I still covered by the statute if I injure them by the movement?
I'd find it very hard to believe that you subjectively did not perceive you were confronted with an emergency to remove somebody from a burning car.
So you think that that's an emergency just because I thought I needed to get them out of where they were.
Yes, you needed to take action because you suspected that their life was in danger or they were in danger of serious bodily harm.
Okay, well, how about now we have the Sweatlicks and they perceive a young girl and their son with blood on them, with headaches, said they've been in an accident, and they tell them to go lie down and we'll watch you, and they talk to them. Why isn't that similar to the accident scene? Because they're responding to what they've perceived.
Because they do not, either subjectively or objectively, and I'll explain why I say objectively as well, neither subjectively nor objectively treat this as though this is an emergency. We have to go back to the definition of the word, emergency. The definition of the word means action taken immediately and urgently. It has a very clear temporal component, which seems to be completely whitewashed out of the statute by the defense claim here.
Well, Counselor, if I go in the ER and I'm not breathing, and I need emergency care for that, and I still can't breathe in an hour, I hope they don't forget about me and say it's not an emergency anymore. Isn't it driven by the condition of the person, not the time that you're dealing with?
When you're talking about immunity, you have to look at the person who is invoking the immunity and their conduct, because the statute says the person who is rendering emergency care. It doesn't say the person who is injured has an injury that objectively through the medical profession would be considered to be an emergency situation. It's the person rendering emergency care. You got to open that door to entitle yourself to immunity. Once you open that door, then, and you perceive you're dealing with an emergency and you take action, objectively demonstrable, consistent with your perception of an emergency, such as calling 911 or saying, okay, let's get them in the car, let's go. If you take that action, then you're immune, because now you're rendering emergency care, not just any care, not just any assistance. You're rendering emergency care, and you're immune for the care you provided from that time, till the delivery to competent medical professionals. You have to do that in order to strike an appropriate balance between the Good Samaritan statute and practicing medicine without a license.
Counsel? You agree that summary judgment can be rendered here on the issue of immunity?
On these facts, absolutely.
Okay. You had a Court of Appeals, and you're here, in effect, supporting the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Correct.
Okay. And what did the Court of Appeals do that you support, that you would say, hey, this court should just adopt this language? Because what we're doing is defining statutory terms, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what do you like? And then I want you to tell me what you dislike about the Court of Appeals. What you think, where they went astray, and you got a little problem here because you have two decisions in the Court of Appeals. You got a majority that two signed on to and a minority that one signed on to, although they ultimately agreed in your favor. Okay.
I was just going to say, actually, I like both.
The one is fine. You pick. You tell us. You could like them both because they're not contrary. They argued
different. They reached the same result for different reasons.
That's right. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first, the Court of Appeals, in its decision, refers to a definition of emergency in the layperson context. And they talk about it in terms of the temporal context for an interim period of time of an interim sort of an urgent nature. And I think they got that right, because that comports with everybody's common sense definition of an emergency. It's something that requires immediate action, exists for a short period of time, and there are exceptions to that, and I could explain that. But that's what I like about the majority opinion. The interesting thing is Judge Hoover,
the concurring
opinion, talks about we can't have the scene of an emergency. And just so I agree and the plaintiff agrees in this case, that because the statute is phrased the scene of an emergency or accident, it's disjunctive. We can't read one or the other of those words out. It applies to both. We agree that an emergency can follow an injured person. However, you have to include the temporal component in defining a scene of an emergency. And that's what Judge Hoover was referring to in his concurrence. It can't extend indefinitely for, as in this case, 6 to 7 hours. You can't extend that temporal component of the scene of the emergency. So those are the things that we like. And in terms of this, you can think of the examples that both majority opinion and Judge Howard, the trial court judge, referred to. If somebody falls out of a tree stand, or if there's an injury in the woods and the person crawls to the farmhouse and gets there, the scene follows them. But when they get to the farmhouse, how long does that presence at that farmhouse constitute a scene of an emergency? That has to depend upon the perception and the temporal component of the length of time. Some action consistent with that perception is necessary. So we're saying that we agree with those two parts. We think when you put it together, you can reach a very clear and satisfactory definition that a layperson, in the layperson context, renders emergency care at the scene of an emergency or accident when they perceive that, in good faith, that they're dealing with an emergency and act consistent with it, which in this day and age calls for calling 911 or taking action to transport. And for everything between those two periods of time, that's what the statute should apply to.
Now, I'm trying to stay away from the facts of this case, because your hypothetical was when the person fell off the tree stand, dragged himself to the farmer's house, and if you had the bleeding, et cetera, went on, I think everyone here would say, well, that's an emergency, and they call 911. Here, I mean, because of the facts, it's a little different. Does that put a different view on emergency, the fact that you had the son and girlfriend who were, yes, now that's not a big part of the case, but it can you perceive a different emergency there than you did where they didn't have any dealing with the hunter who fell out of the tree stand until he crawled to the farmhouse?
Well, and I understand exactly what you're saying, because that gets to the defense argument that it's an assessment. But the interesting thing is the statute requires affirmative conduct, not omission. It requires rendering emergency care in good faith at the scene of an emergency to trigger it.
But it does say, and that's what I was going to ask you, it says renders emergency care. You're immune from civil liability for acts or omissions in rendering such emergency care. So you can have an omission in emergency care.
You have to render emergency care to begin with, though.
Well, what about cleaning somebody up and saying lie quietly and watching them? When you suspect a head injury, doctors will tell you, you wake them up every hour to make sure that they are conscious and doing well. So isn't that care, affirmative acts of care here?
Let me parse that out just a little bit so we can make sure we're talking about the same case.
Right.
First of all, there was no contact with the doctor that
right.
says check on them.
That.
These people did not say that they've been told in the past that this is what you do. That's not part of this record. But I see what you're – I just want to make sure it started out with the answer that's saying that's not this record. But when you're dealing with that situation, if these people said in their testimony that they felt they were dealing with an emergency situation, then they meet the perception subjective component. Now the next question then is the objective component. Did they take action consistent with that perception, which this court has to define?
Counsel, what's the negligence that you are alleging here? According to opposing counsel, the negligence was failing to call 911 promptly. Is that the negligence? I mean, I'm just trying to see what you're talking about in this case.
The negligence, that would be one of the arguments as to how they were negligent. But the negligence is very simple. We'll leave it to a jury to decide whether they exercised reasonable care under the circumstances they were confronted with at the time. Now, that is a jury question. Mm-hmm. If the jury comes back and says, and Mr. David is successful in saying, well, they were drinking, the parents said that, you know, they were drinking and that kind of stuff, and they could have just as easily assessed that they were drinking and vomiting and throwing up, leave that to the jury. But that's not emergency care. I can't.
That's really your pitch.
Yeah.
This is an emergency.
Yeah, we're saying reasonable care under the circumstances they were confronted with. And if the jury says no, that's what juries are for.
But that is basically our standard of care in Wisconsin for any kind of an act that's claimed to be negligent. So what you're doing is you're imposing our definition of negligence, which is the breach of the duty of reasonable care under the circumstances, as a component of the statute, correct?
No, absolutely
not.
No.
Why not then?
Don't want it there because the statute applies, and I am trying to be as clear as I possibly can. You have a door to get into this house of Good Samaritan immunity. The door requires rendering, that you render emergency care at the scene of an emergency. Now, in our brief, we said, and the defense position is very simple, any care, any treatment, anything you do with a person who is injured constitutes emergency care. Well, if that's the case, then the word emergency might as well be stricken from the statute by this court. Because emergency is a word that has a common understood meaning.
Well, it means an unexpected occurrence, Counselor. I mean, you want to, when you tie it to emergency care, and when courts use it in a variety of situations, they use it in a variety of ways, but you can also just interpret it as an unexpected occurrence, and certainly this was.
If you want to throw out the context in which you're using the word, yes.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that, but I'm having a lot of problems with being able to line up this immunity statute, which with the possibility of failing to adequately perceive the injury to the person. And it seems to me you're telling me that if they don't adequately perceive it, they're negligent, and if they do adequately perceive it, then they can't benefit under the statute because they didn't take care objectively appropriate to their perception. So it
no,
kinda,
no, nope? That's not what okay. We're saying. We're not defining in the first instance what actually is wrong with the person, because as lay people we shouldn't be involved in that. We shouldn't be trying to diagnose as lay people. What we're doing is we're saying, if somebody presents, say as in this case, to my door bleeding, they're a guest of my house, and that gets back to the one of the issues that was raised earlier about whether there's a duty to begin with, but we're not dealing with that right now. But say it's a stranger comes to my door and they're bleeding and they told me they've been in an accident and they got headaches and I can smell alcohol on their breath and they're throwing up. If I perceive whether they really have a bad injury or not, if I perceive in my mind subjectively that this person's hurt and I got to do something, then subjective test is met. Now the next question is, do I take action consistent with that perception? If I call 911 or I say, here, let's take you in, what should I do? Talk to them, find out if they're doing if they're anything, get them to the hospital. Get them, call somebody with competent care. Call a doctor, do something objectively consistent with that perception, I got the immunity.
But you see, you don't have an omission, a failure to act in what you're talking about.
Yes,
and that's what we're talking about here.
Yes, you do. Then let's take it a step further and say, really, their condition called for the application of a tourniquet, or their condition really called for something that some lay people might know of in terms of CPR or a cardiac massage, and I don't do it because I'm just hysterical about this bloody person at my front door.
Right.
And I don't do that. That's an omission. Somebody could second guess that. But you, before you get to the omission standpoint, you have to get through the door. There has to be rendering emergency care. You don't get in the Good Samaritan house of immunity without doing that.
So if you goof up on the first step, you're out of the statute. So you got to make an appropriate first step before you can use the statute. And then if you goof up, you're okay.
Actually, the first step, when you say appropriate first step,
assessing
you're in control. You're in control. It's your perception. It's your perception. Not mine, not any justice on this court. It's the person who answers the door and sees the bloody person. If they perceive that person is in serious, in jeopardy of serious harm and act on it, whatever that action is, and we can look at those actions to see if it's consistent with that subjective perception, they have immunity.
Oh, but it has to be objective, too, under your definition.
You have to have the subjective initial and then the objective action consistent with that subjective perception. I don't know how you do it. Otherwise, all I can say...
Subjective is enough, then, initially. I mean, you got a guy who just watches the playgrounds, and every time a kid gets hurt, he thinks they ought to saw off the limb. Subjectively, he thinks there's an emergency, and they got to do something.
I've been trying to make a point, but I'm talking about everything has to be modified by good faith. In that situation, the kid scratched his knee. Somebody says, gets out his saw and goes over there and says, oh, my gosh, that's going to get infected. We got to saw off the leg right now. Is that a good faith conduct? I wouldn't.
I don't know what good faith means. Yeah,
if I was on the jury, I would say no.
What does good faith mean?
Right.
Good faith can have, as I said in our brief, it's a ubiquitous term in the law.
Right.
You use it in various circumstances. It could be ill motive. It could be with a proper motive. It could be with a proper understanding.
And that's not really an issue in this case because you don't have enough facts.
I don't think we get to the issue of good faith. But if we do, I think there's enough to say it's an issue of fact.
Thank you, Mr. Golan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. David? You have a few moments in rebuttal.
Thank you. I can't help but feel that by utilizing a subjective perception to determining whether or not the scene of an emergency exists does two terrible things. It subjects the person to liability if they are incorrect in their initial assessment. What it does is it says all emergency care might be subject to the immunity except one type of emergency care, and that is the assessment. And boy, you better not get that one wrong. Because what is really happening in this case? An assessment up front was done wrong, and as a result, they are subject to liability. If their perception was that no emergency care existed in this case, could Merlin and Stephanie Switlick have gone back to the fire and sat down and done nothing? I don't think that that is really what we want to be suggesting here by the application of this immunity.
Well, Mr. David, let me follow up on Mr. Gola's last point. Look at it from a slightly different perspective. If you can have an omission, if you take it in and you can assess it, and you see that, okay, there's a problem here. I got a couple kids here bleeding and they're vomiting and they've got headaches. So let's get them in here. Let's get them in the house. You know, let's get them in the bed and we'll keep an eye on them. Now, under this other hypothetical, you can have omissions as long as you take action. Why aren't you arguing that that's enough under his prompt?
Under the facts of this case, I think the allegation is that their perception was that there was not the scene of an emergency. They're alleging that they didn't act the way that they were supposed to. Now, I suppose you could say that in reality, their conduct, they did perceive the scene of an emergency. And the acts that they took were in furtherance of that belief. And the allegation here is simply that they omitted things that other people would have done. And I guess in that case, you could say that, yeah, the immunity applies. I mean, there was never any questions that were asked directly to them about whether or not did you perceive this as a quote-unquote emergency situation. There were questions asked to them about what did you see, what did you observe. But I suspect that what could be done here is to say, yeah, they did perceive an emergency situation and they acted. Now, the allegation is that they omitted some things from there. Well, statute applies to omissions. But I think the other way of doing it is by not utilizing the subjective approach to determining whether or not the scene of an emergency exists and use the objective standard. Is the condition of the person such that intervention by another individual would objectively prove to be a benefit or likely to be a benefit to that person? The allegation or the allegations in this case here say there was an emergency situation. In some respects, I think that for purposes of this case, that kind of is the issue. They're alleging the existence of an emergency situation, and then there were omissions. That's covered by the statute.
The problem is if you don't have a temporal limit, what happens is the, quote, emergency caregiver in effect isolates that patient, isolates the injured person, and stops other people from giving care. Right? I mean, now these two kids are in a house, doors closed, they're at the total mercy of someone who's taking care of them.
There are scenarios in which the care that is provided by the caregiver is going to prove to be negligent. That's why it's an immunity. Mm-hmm. Not all situations are going to be that the care provided by the layperson Samaritan is in fact non-negligent. Mm-hmm. There will be scenarios like
that's
that.
That's the whole point of it. If it was not negligent, you wouldn't have to. You wouldn't need immunity.
In many respects, the beauty of this statute is not in how it affects a result in this case. It is how the immunity works in this case to encourage, hopefully, many, many, many other interventions, the vast majority of which, or maybe all of them, we never hear about. We never see them.
So how would you write this opinion?
I would write the opinion that there was an allegation, that summary judgment was brought against a claim that alleged that there was a failure to provide emergency care at the scene of an emergency. The scene of the emergency existed because objectively there were those types of injuries that would constitute that, and it was alleged. Secondly, they acted in good faith in this case. There's nothing of record to put into dispute the good faith efforts of the Switlicks, and as a result, the immunity applies.
Counselor, before you go on, is there anything that was asked of them in their depositions about the effect of their perception of these underage people drinking and the calling of an ambulance?
The only questions, I don't believe that there were any questions that were asked about calling an ambulance.
Well,
there was the testimony that was given by Stephanie Switlick that at one point in time they thought about whether or not they should bring her in. With regards to the issue of the consumption of alcohol, there were some questions and answers that were asked that essentially, I think, went to the point they were trying to elicit information from Merlin Switlick and from Apollo Switlick that essentially he was not under the influence at the time of the accident. I think the reason those questions were asked was try to cut off a claim of contributory negligence for the plaintiff getting onto the back of the ATV of a person that was intoxicated. Those are the questions that are in there. Did you think or did you perceive that they were under the influence? No. Those are what's in the record. On the one issue of whether or not there is sufficient, I'm sorry, I've got the red light.
Thank you, but counsel. Thank you, Mr. David, and thank you, Mr. Gola, for your argument on the Good Samaritan law, which we have not previously visited. So that will end our hearing on 05 AP 121. The court is in recess.